Christian Bush is starting again. Again, the veteran musician is half of the hit country duo Sugarland, and as that group takes an indefinite hiatus, he's taken the opportunity to release his first solo album, Southern Gravity. But Bush is no stranger to starting over. He calls this release his third first record. In the 1990s, he reached for mainstream success with his band Billy Pilgrim. Bush recently sat down with WABE contributor Mara Davis ahead of his show at the Variety Playhouse for a conversation about his highs and lows in the music industry and what it means to reinvent yourself again and again.
Wanna buy you a drink, maybe one for this whole town. I may not have that much, but I don't mind spreading it around.
Christian Bush is here, and he is an Atlanta native.
Yes, I am. And well, I mean, technically, I've been here since I went to college.
So we'll give that.
I can have dual residency, right?
Well, you're from the South. So
I'm from the South, but actually, I think I've lived here longer than I lived in Sevierville. So my life has progressed to such a degree that I'm of age that I could officially be from Atlanta forever.
I've been here 20 years, and I own that I'm an Atlantan now.
I'm with that.
Never seen a hearse with a trailer. Never seen a hearse with a trailer.
So let's peel back the layers just a little bit. Now, we all know you as one half of the legendary, iconic country band called Sugarland. Mm-hmm. Also Billy Pilgrim.
Right, right.
And you were behind the scenes of so many artists who you hear on country music, radio, and live, and also a solo artist.
Right.
So let's start with, how did you end up in Atlanta from Tennessee?
It's very simple. I ended up going to college here, and I went to Emory University, and I arrived in Atlanta in 1988, which is a really interesting time, because the hobby or the vocation that I had kind of adopted, besides being a student, is the one thing I did well is I made records. But you can't go to school to make records anywhere. You have to pick a school in a town that makes records. So instead of maybe Nashville or Austin, or at the time, you know, it wasn't even Seattle yet, I ended up here. And when I walked into the town, this was kind of where REM was moving into their first foray into a major label. You had the Black Crowes hadn't really turned into the Black Crowes yet. The Indigo Girls had just about to release their first record, happened that fall, their first major label record on Epic. B-52s had kind of been, you know, it's all the Athens stuff had spilled into Atlanta, and it was a very healthy music scene. So, and I had gone to a boys' school in high school, so there were girls here. That was fantastic.
So girls at Emory, music, and you. But what was your major when you went to Emory? What were you? I know you wanted to do music, but what was your backup?
Yeah, I wasn't able to read music. I grew up as an experiment for a program called the Suzuki program, which is this Japanese method of teaching music at the time that your brain learns language. So between 3 and 5 years old. And I was in the pilot program at the University of Tennessee. My mother would drive me in from the mountains and I'd learn music by ear. So funny enough, I couldn't really get into a music school because I couldn't read. But I could go and make a record, which, you know, I could write music and I could play anything I could hear. So if it was on the radio, I could learn it. So that's how I kind of ended up in Atlanta and ended up at Emory. And then while I was there, you know, Emory's a great medical school. I thought, oh, you know, maybe I'm supposed to be a doctor or a lawyer or whatever else your parents want you to be. And suddenly, about a year into it, they created the creative writing program there. And I realized, because it was founded while I was in school, and I thought to myself, you can get college credit for making stuff up? I'm totally in. Sign me up. And so I was, again, in the pilot program. I was the guinea pig for the creative writing department.
Seems being the guinea pig has worked very well for you.
Yeah, I'm the experimental animal here. In my years.
So let's fast forward to Billy Pilgrim, which was a time when, you know, there were bands starting to come up like Drivin' and Cryin'. And that was part of the Georgia, but also getting more into the mainstream as far as like rock is back. It was like leading up to grunge when you said Seattle wasn't Seattle yet. And Billy Pilgrim was like nipping at the heels at that. Let's talk a little bit more about that band.
You know, it was a great time, you know, the early 90s for a songwriter and for a dreamers who were songwriters or people in rock bands. There was a really kind of a cool thing that had happened a couple years before. Toad the Wet Sprocket happened, and before that, Charlie Sexton happened, which for people who are kind of aficionados, they were the two 17-year-olds that got signed to a major label deal. Before that, nobody would touch you. You'd be a child act, or an adult. They had to wait till you were in your 20s. And those two guys kind of opened the door for all of us. At the time, I was 18, 19 years old, and I thought, this is possible? You can actually convince somebody that I could get out of college into a record deal? I mean, can this even happen? And so I dedicated myself to this. Every day I'd wake up, I'd write more music, I'd start another band, I'd do whatever it took to try to get a record deal. And I would write to the, I went to the store and I bought the this Business of Music book, if you've ever been to the store. But all of us have kind of seen it through the years. But they update it every year. And in the back, there's an appendix of every A&R person on earth currently has their job. And I'm sure they hate publishing their names and addresses in that thing because kids like me send them music. But I sent every single one. And I kept all my rejection letters and I would constantly stay in touch. But somebody said yes. Somebody at Atlantic Records, Jen Stark, said yes. And she said, oh my gosh, I love these songs. And I love your band. Can I come see you somewhere? And I said, sure. Well, we're from Atlanta. You know, she said, well, are you playing in New York? I'm like, yes, which we weren't. And I immediately got on the phone and I was like, can somebody get me a show in New York? Just anywhere. I'll play like in a deli just because I might get a record deal out of this. Can someone please help? And my, you know, my partner at the time, Andrew, a great singer, like phenomenal world-class singer. And I don't think he believed me, you know, that this was, we had a shot. And, but we did, we got a record deal on Atlantic Records. It wasn't very much money. And I think we were a little bit of the like, oh, let's try it, throw it against the wall. As long as it doesn't cost much and they stay out of our way, it'll be like they're not even here. But if for some reason they happen to succeed, well, that's great. So put it in your mind that we signed the same month as Hootie and the Blowfish, as Jewel, Rob Thomas, Matchbox 20, Godsmack, and Billy Pilgrim. So we were the new roster in 1993. Stone Temple Pilots was the big, like, they had just signed and they hadn't released their record yet. And it was a very interesting time to be in music because people were hitting the jackpot. People were doing one song, like, you know, like Ed with Collective Soul. They had just signed up there too. And they had just turned in their song. It hadn't been released yet, but they were like, man, this could be good. And, you know, Collective Soul hit the jackpot. And then Darius and Hootie and these guys, they put in one song and 16 million records pop out. Right?
So at this time, are you thinking, oh my God, this is so happening for us?
Well, I really thought that maybe we could do it. And I don't think there was disappointment when it didn't happen, but there was a real learning that immediately kicked in where I was like, you know what? I can see that the guy standing next to me is not better than me, but he hit it and somehow knocked it out of the park. What does that take? Well, and I started to observe, and it takes a lot of luck. It also takes a whole lot of preparation. Like, you have to know how to go do it four times. Like, I watched some of these bands only do it once. I watched some of them do it four or five times. And I just learned the whole time. I stood next to everybody. I was in the hallway. I was always, you know, hanging around that your studio trying to figure out what was going on next. So when you fast forward through Billy Pilgrim, we sold, I mean, to me, we sold a lot of records, but to, you know, compared to Hootie, we didn't. But we sold like 250,000 albums or something, but which was 249 more thousand than I'd ever sold. So I was so excited. And I learned how to tour. We went around the world with Melissa Etheridge. I ended up playing with like Beck and Bob Dylan and Crowded House and all these bands that I just love. I couldn't believe I got to sit and watch and meet and understand. And but still, I was the blonde, long, blonde-haired, you know, youngest kid in the room. Always been that, I guess, till now.
But isn't it essentially what you're saying? And you've had, and I want to get to Sugarland in a second, but, you know, you have these peaks and valleys. And as a solo artist, in a way, you're almost doing that all over again.
I am. This is my first record that we're talking about today.
Which is crazy to think, based on all your success. So Billy Pilgrim breaks up.
We made a bunch of records after the label. We left the label after two albums. And we had two albums before the label. And afterwards, I kind of just didn't want to give up. I didn't think we were done yet.
Mm-hmm.
So we went into this never-ending recording cycle that lasted for about 4 years. And during that 4 years, I put out records for other people. I did a lot of things, and we continued to play. But at the end of that kind of 4-year recording, we had the world's best record that we've ever done. And I still think, hands down, it was the, like, and then there was this. And now if we pick it back up again, it'll be from a very fresh place. But everything that we tried to achieve kind of closed out with that last Billy Pilgrim record. It was called Billy Pilgrim in the Time Machine, which finally gave a reference back to the name of the band, which is, you know, a Kurt Vonnegut reference, because I was a huge Kurt Vonnegut fan because I was a creative writing major. And so it finally closed out, and we made 1,000 copies of that record, and then we were done.
She's been studying for years. She's still confused. It'll sneak right up. I'm scared she'll never see it coming. Wide open arms of love, and she just keeps running.
My mother passed away, and our studio burned all within 2 weeks of each other. So suddenly, you know, the world just looked completely different to me. And I had just turned 30. I was like, huh, okay. Well, you know, at least nobody died in the fire. And oh my gosh, you know, if you've ever lost a parent, you know, suddenly you get this kind of orphan brain, is what I call it. You start to think, oh, I'm the only one left. Okay, I'm in charge now. I was the oldest. My parents were divorced. And so it sets you up for different kinds of career choices and different kind of risks.
So did you think then, wow, I had my success. I got to travel the world. I put out great music. Maybe it's the career path is not music. Maybe
right.
I need to move on to something else. But that doesn't happen. Then you become part of one of the biggest country bands of all time, Sugarland.
Yep.
And I always find it amazing about you how here you were in this alternative hard rocking situation, and then you're writing sweet love songs.
Right.
And wearing a cowboy hat.
Well, the cowboy hat was just to try to convince my friends. It was an accident. It was totally an accident. But yes, so bringing people to the story now, suddenly I'm this kid who pulled off the Wheaties box dream in Atlanta. You know, I was after Driving and Crying and after Michelle Malone, then John Mayer got signed. It was all out of Eddie's Attic. And then John Mayer signs to Sony, maybe Columbia. And then suddenly there's just empty space. Like, it dries up. People stop coming to Atlanta to discover music. And then it's me again as Sugarland. We got signed to Mercury in Nashville. But in that in-between time, I had sat with Kristen Hall, who's a local songwriter, and she had said, let's start a band. I was like, I don't need a band. You know, band, like, I need a hole in the head. I've had a band. She's like, no, let's start a country band. I'm like, stop it. We don't need to start a country band. And she was like, well, play me the songs you're writing. Because she had just come back to town. I played them. She was like, huh, those are country songs. These are not country songs. I'm like, I'm a punk alt rocker. Like, he's like, she's like, nope, those are country songs. I'm like, I don't think so. And I don't sound like anybody on the radio. She goes, well, we'll find somebody to sing. I said, okay. So we started holding auditions for the songs that had been written. And we went through some good, good people. I mean, Vanessa Olivares was one of our first ones, and she ended up on American Idol. Corey English was ended up being a host, a TV host. Even, you know, Michelle Malone was slated to come in. And funny enough, you know, later, just recently this summer, she played in my band all summer. And I just about lost my mind looking up every day and going, oh my God, it's Michelle Malone. You know, like, that was one of the first people I saw when I came to Atlanta. So when Kristen suggested Jennifer Nettles, I thought, well, you know, yeah. And she sang, and part of the process was to write a song together, and the second song we wrote was Baby Girl.
Dear Mom and Dad, please send money. I'm so broke that it ain't funny. Don't need much, just enough to get me through. Please don't worry, cause I'm all right. Playing here at the bar tonight. This time I'm gonna make our dreams come true. Well, I love you more than anything in the world. Love your baby girl.
So I kind of looked across at her. I was like, you sure you want to do this? Because I know how to do it. But you've got to be able to stomach it. You got to be able to leave home and roll the dice, because this is possible. And this song is amazing, and it tells the truth. And it tells the truth about me and you and maybe a lot of other people. And country music is kind of it's at first it's about the truth, because the listeners always can tell if you're faking it. And she said, sure, I'll try anything. And I think she kept her own gig going for a while, and Sugarland thing moved fast. And the hat was literally on eBay on the like buy now button for like $7.99. I hit that because my friends were like, no, there's no way you've started a country band. I'm like, just shut it and come to the show. And I kind of put that hat on, and I wore it for maybe 10 shows, 15 shows. And what do you know, the last show that I wore it on was in Nashville at 12th and Porter, and they signed us that night. And so, and they did it kind of without consulting the rest of the label. The head of the label did. And Luke Lewis, the head of Universal Music Group, comes down and he's like, hey guys, my name's Luke and I have two questions. Which label would you like to be on, and how soon can you start? Luke kind of walked into his office the next morning and said, I signed a band. And all they had was a picture of us, and I had the hat on. So the hat stayed. I just didn't say anything. I just didn't speak up about it.
Well, it's certainly part of your signature on stage look. Sugarland, literally, it pops pretty quickly. And, I mean, that's got to be overwhelming to have such a high, then such a low, and then have that high again, and then that grueling pace of being in a country band, touring, right, interviewing, because that's one thing about country radio is they're very in bed with the fans. And as far as you as an act, it's a whole different game.
It's a whole different experience than rock and roll or pop music. I think the trick is to be honest with your audience. You know, one of the cool things that we always did at Sugarland is we never really spoke down to anybody or played down to anybody. Like, if we did a cover song, I whipped out an REM song. You know, like, hey, let's play this. Can we play a Counting Crows song tonight? You know, can we do like a Nelly song right now? And suddenly you start to realize that the people you're performing for are you. You know, they're just like you, except maybe they live somewhere else. And maybe they don't have the fantastic job you do, but they probably have the same age kids you do, and they probably drive carpool just like you do, and they got to go to the grocery store just like you do. And country music is, for me, about connecting strangers. So for me, it's when you're at a show and you're singing some song with Baby Girl, and it means something to you. And the person next to you is also singing Baby Girl, and it means something to them. Right? And maybe, for a minute, you get to meet that person, and you're a little less lonely.
Absolutely nobody knows me better. No one that can make me feel so good. How do we stay so long together? Everybody said we never would.
You and Jennifer have put the brakes on the band. You're each doing your solo careers.
Right.
I know that's the question that everybody
asks.
Yeah,
go ahead. Let's dive in.
I mean, it's like I can't interview you without saying. But it seems like you're both very comfortable in this break. You know, I don't like to, you know, you hear about bands breaking up. You hear about REM, like we're never touring again. But even though you guys seem to be in your own worlds, nobody has said that's it, it's done. So there's still.
Right. So this has all been kind of instigated by Jennifer. So she wanted to have a baby. She wanted to get married. She'd married Todd, and then they got divorced, and then she really fell in love. And she was like, hey, I want to start a family. And at the exact same time as, hey, I'm 3 months pregnant, was I want to put out a solo record. I was like, cool. Seems like I'm about to get some time off. And I was kind of excited about that because I haven't really been in town for my kids' birthdays in 8 years.
It was grueling, and you guys had been through a lot.
Holy moly. We had a terrible stage accident at the Indiana State Fair, and there was just all sorts of crazy things that had gone on, and she wanted to hit the button, you know, and Jennifer used to be my opening act, you know, in Billy Pilgrim, so I knew exactly what she sounded like, and I was excited that other people were going to get to hear that, and so in that time, you know, we parked the bus. I came home. I was like, this is going to be time off. Normally, I write about a song a month, give or take. And from the moment I parked the bus till probably about 4 months ago, it's been a song every other day.
Stuck like glue. You and me, baby, we're stuck like glue.
And then I think creativity, especially if you're trying to balance it with commercialism, like I'm obsessed with, right? It takes a certain amount of dedication in the dark. You've got to sit there with yourself and not know what's going to happen next and just start making things up. And then figure out after you've made it up whether it's any good.
Well, it is good, and you've gotten great reviews for Southern Gravity, and you've been touring. And this is what is exciting to me about you, is that, yes, you had this great success in two different bands, and now you're having this great success as a solo artist. But you were really, really working hard at it. You're big on social media. You're touring like crazy. You are meeting and greeting with fans. And it's a grind all over again, right? It's a different kind of grind.
Yeah, the grind now is even harder than it was at the beginning of Sugarland. It's even, and that was harder than it was, you know, doing radio tour with Billy Pilgrim. Now, the machine and the business that is the music business, especially radio music business, is everyday grueling.
But in a sense, you could probably quit tomorrow. Okay, maybe
probably not.
I mean, okay. So but you could probably ease back on all the hard work you've been doing because you've done very well with Sugarland. You've written so many songs for people, so you're not starving. But yet you're very hungry.
Yeah, well, I can't get the songs to anybody if I don't work. You know, how am I going to get anybody to hear this? It's no different. I mean, I did this radio tour with Sheryl Crow in 1994, you know, and I saw her do it again in 2011.
Isn't that interesting? Especially because, look, she had to rebrand her career.
Same thing. Darius did the same thing. Like, he was like, hey, man, so what are you doing now? I'm like, well, I have a country band. He's like, shut it. I was like, yeah, it's called Sugarland. He goes, wait, you're in Sugarland? Like, he didn't recognize me because I didn't have the long blonde hair. And then when he showed up, like, you know, he played with us all the time. And then suddenly, you know, now he's a country star, right? And so I had to talk to him the other day and be like, hey, man, I want to give you my record. You're not going to believe this. He goes, oh, are you kidding? Did you just start all over again? And I was like, yeah. He's like, totally. I get it. I do it too. You know, and it's this connection to music as not just a life calling or a vocation or as a job, but as the thing you do, you know, and you just want to get better at the thing you do. Yeah, baby, you light me up.